This is Over the Garden Gate, a program brought to you by the University of California Cooperative Extension Master Gardener Program of Tuolumne County. The mission of the UCCE Master Gardeners is to provide research-based gardening information to the public. If you would like to contact our Master Gardener Program, please call our hotline, which is area code 209-533-5912. The hotline is not manned full-time, but we do pick up our messages and we will get back to you within the week.
My name is Jordan. I'm a permaculture farmer. I've been doing this for 15 years or so, something along those lines. I started out just wild foraging foods and so on and so on, and then I learned that the foods that you wild forage you could plant at your house, and little by little I learned that the best thing, the way to do things is to mimic nature. So the mimicking of the forest ecosystem and the nutrient cycling processes and the pest cycles and stuff is best to mimic as far as nature goes. And eventually I started doing this without even knowing what permaculture was, and then someone comes to me and says, hey, you're doing permaculture. I said, oh, cool. And then I just continued on. And a couple months later, someone else said, hey, you're doing permaculture. Oh, well, okay, cool. Finally, about the fifth or sixth or maybe tenth person, I said, I gotta look into this permaculture thing. Sure enough, I was doing permaculture. So the way that I explain it is people have been doing permaculture for thousands of years. They called it life. And if you didn't do a very good job at life, meaning you weren't sustainable with your practices, you didn't eat good healthy food, you didn't get good exercise, you basically got sick and you died, or your village died, or your community died, etc., etc., and you just slowly petered off. Now, what permaculture is an ethics-based design system. So basically what that means is you're using design to achieve certain goals, but through the set and the mindset of the ethics. So the ethics of permaculture are care of people, care of earth, and return of surplus to the first two ethics. So the care of people is care of people and all people. So keep them healthy, keep them happy, keep them wise, do all the things you can to support and help everyone that you can, because the more support you give, usually the more support you get in return. The happier everyone is, the more productive everyone is, the more good community conversations you get going with people, because everyone's on a really stimulated mindset. Versus the opposite is when you start not caring for people, you get people angry with you. When you're not caring for people, you get people who aren't thinking very well or thinking very straight, and so on and so on. So we're always trying to care for people. The next is care for the earth, which is the earth and all its systems and it's all its animals. So we're caring for the nutrient cycle, the water cycle, we're caring for the pest cycle, we're caring for all the birds, the gophers, the bugs, the bees, etc., etc. Basically all those things, because as we all know, they're all connected. And return of surplus was designed to, as it says, return any surplus to the first two ethics. So let's say, for example, today at the farmer's market, I had leftover peppers. Well, care of people would be return that to someone who needs it. For example, there's a trailer park across the street from the farm, and usually with the leftovers I go through and just divvy it up and give it to the people out there that need it so they can get some good nutrition, and so on and so on. And then every now and then they get happy and they come and help at the farm. So it always comes back and helps. So return of surplus to people would be that way. The return of surplus to the earth would be, I'm going to take that material and I'm going to compost it. I'm going to go feed it to an animal. I'm going to do something else with it instead of just, say, trash it to the bin, which in the very long term of the earth is returning to the earth, because it's going to go into the dump, it's going to go to the earth, et cetera, et cetera. 10 million years later, it'll come back as oil, which potentially some future civilization will ruin and destroy for. So we're always trying to keep these cycles to a what we call a positive loop, so that everything you do interacts with the next thing positively and exponentially expands. So instead of what most farms, for example, they start out really good, and then the next year they're not as good, and then the next year they're not as good, and generations later you have, an example would be, we used to get sweet potato slips from this guy in the valley, and he absolutely hated doing it. But he did it anyways, because it was passed on from his dad and passed on from his grandpa, so he wanted to just keep the tradition alive, but he absolutely hated it because the practices they used, the soil got worse, the ecology got worse, and everything got worse, expenses got worse, et cetera, et cetera. It cost him $80,000 an acre to plant sweet potatoes. I can plant sweet potatoes on an acre for about $200 because of the practices we use and the hole that I did not dig myself into. So a lot of times we're trying to use permaculture practices to be what we call regenerative. We're trying to not just be sustainable where, okay, we're staying at this bar, I want it to be better next year, and better next year, and better next year, and better next year, and better next year. So in doing this, we use the permaculture principles, which basically follow many different things. There's catch and store energy. So we're always trying to catch and store energy as much as we can. An example of this would be in the winter, we're trying to catch and store water, because in this climate, we actually get more rain than we ever could possibly need. It just comes here, and it doesn't come here. So, for example, not this last winter, but the winter before, we got all that rain. We got 100 inches of rain on the farm. And that comes to something like 15 million gallons an acre. It's a ridiculous amount of water. But if you have systems that are low infiltration rates, damaged soil, hard surface runoff, 95% of that water left. So we got 100 inches of rain that year, but most people's ground locally probably maybe sucked up 5. So we're trying to catch and store energy by using rainwater catchment processes, terracing, swales, hugel cultures, just different techniques and methods to slow it, stop it, spread it, sink it. We're trying to get that water to go in the ground as much as possible. And the longer you do this, the more hydrated your landscape becomes. And on a small scale, you can do pretty cool things like dry farm vegetables. We dry farm watermelons, we dry farm tomatoes, we dry farm melons, we dry farm winter squash, we dry farm all those things, meaning no irrigation at all. All of the cherry tomatoes I was selling at the farmer's market today were dry farmed, so they all had no irrigation. And it's not that they don't have no water. That's the key. Everyone says, oh, you didn't irrigate them, they didn't get no water. Well, it's not that they didn't get any water. It's I captured and stored the water during the winter and created a condition where it would hold it as long as possible so that those tomatoes can do their thing through the summer. Next principle is the problem is the solution. A lot of times you end up with certain problems in your garden, and this is happening and that's happening, and you always blame it on that little problem. But in the reality, if you change your mindset just slightly, those problems usually become solutions. So for example, we don't do any gopher management at all anymore. At the beginning, the Dambackers and everyone was, kill the gophers, do this and do that. Well, it turns out a lot of the infiltration rates in the winter come from gophers because they have all their tunnels in the ground. Instead of the water running off from the surface, it goes into the tunnels. Little by little, the soil gets better, the soil gets a little more hydrated, more plants start growing, you start polyculturing things. So instead of planting one specific crop, we're planting many, many different crops. Little by little, the gopher damage goes away and gopher waste. So we run a whole farm and we do absolutely zero gopher control. I lose very, very, very little to the gophers. I think I've seen 3 plants I've lost the entire year. 2 of them were carrots. And that was in a bed of 500 pounds of carrots. So I lost less than 1% of what we're doing with that. So in some ways, the solution of having the gophers is increased rainwater infiltration, increased soil building. Gophers also, when they eat the dirt and it goes through them and they poop it out, that actively stimulates endomycorrhizal fungus. So everyone knows that mycorrhizal fungus is the relationship between the plants and the mycorrhizal fungus in the soil, so that this plant provides sugar, it trades sugar to the mycorrhizal fungus, which trades it nutrients and minerals to the plant. So this way there's a symbiotic relationship going on. So gophers stimulate that. The more and more and more we're going into this, the more and more we're realizing that the gophers just keep promoting more. One crazy cool example this spring was sitting there doing some weeding, and I pulled this plant and just kind of left a nice little hole for where the gopher just kind of went under it. And what comes popping out of that hole was hundreds of frogs. So the ecosystems, secondary ecosystems that these gophers are creating are frog habitat, which is pest control. So the strawberries don't get bugs anymore because the frogs eat them all. And there's toads living in there. There's actually even little birds living in the gopher tunnels, which I'm not sure which species it was, but I saw birds flying in and out of one of their little holes. So now we're talking manure embedding in the ground, so we're increasing soil organic matter, and this is all just kind of the side effect of just not killing the gophers, which was the problem, which turned into the solution. Another one is creativity is the biggest limit to abundance. If you can't imagine it, you'll never have it. If you can't imagine growing a tomato without water, it'll never happen. If you can't imagine having a tomato plant that gives you 100 pounds of tomatoes, never going to happen. If you can't imagine being rich in greens for the rest of winter, it's not going to happen. So think big, basically. Think big because everything's basically possible through the natural systems in one way, shape, or form or another. Another good principle is, start small and grow bigger over time. So a lot of times people will come and, let's say you gave them this little plot. The first thing they want to do is fill it up. And a lot of times, your knowledge isn't equal to the skill required it would take to run that large of an area. You don't have the energy to do such a large area, and maybe you don't even have the time to do such a large area. Versus if you slowly incremented places and times and spots to get that one small area to 100% before you moved on to the next spot, that way you don't have to go back and manage it. Versus a lot of times you get that to about 40%, 50%, okay, well, let's go over here and do this. Well, because it's only at 40%, you have to go back and do that while you're building this new bed. And then a lot of times I see doing consulting and stuff, there's this bed way over here that's at 20%, and here's another one at 30%, and here's another one at 50%, and here's another one at 40%, and it's all these beds that are not even half production that they think they could be. Versus instead, high-density polyculture, which means growing many crops in the same spot on a smaller area, would yield that person more food, higher nutrition, less problems, with less work. Instead of trying to manage a lot more and more. A lot of times everyone's like, oh, we don't have enough. Well, let's just add more. Well, in permaculture, we want to make what we have more efficient so that you get what you want out of it with the amount of energy you do. So I run basically the whole farm by myself. I do all the planting, all the harvesting, all the weeding, all the watering. And the only way that's possible is because permaculture design. We've used principles and practices to make things simpler, to make things easier, to make things more efficient, to make nature do most of the work, not me. So a lot of the tilling is done by worms. So as we jokingly say, I do farm by myself, but it's more like one farmer and 10 million worms and 5,000 birds and two gophers and 10,000 frogs and et cetera, et cetera. So really we're trying to use the natural ecosystem towards our favor instead of against it, because a lot of times you'll never win that battle. The gopher battle, there was many, many, many gophers trapped every week before we finally got tired of that and slowly said, what are we doing here? Let's move on to the process of creating a garden where that doesn't have to happen. And once again, if you couldn't imagine a garden that had gophers and you still got your food, you could never even work towards that if you didn't even think it was possible. So once again, creativity is the biggest limit to abundance. We're using a lot of techniques to save seed and create new varieties, because new varieties are always important. It's such a shame that we've lost quite a few. They say that if you took all the apples from the 1800s and you condensed it into, let's say, a dollar form, we have 1 cent left as far as the diversity of apples that there used to be. Because as farms grow, they get bigger and they get bigger, and they start de-diversifying, so they get less varieties, less crops, less cultivars, and you end up with one farm growing 100 acres of Nantes carrots. I'm sure they might be organic Nantes carrots, but it's still 100 acres of Nantes carrots. The ecological destruction from that is huge. There's no benefit. The soil loss is huge. Versus on a smaller scale, your yields go up, and you'll use less of those problems, and once again, you do a little bit less work and a little you get higher nutrition stuff as well. So one of the things we're mainly trying to do as permaculture farmers is farm microbes, because everything forms from the soil up. There's no system on the planet that doesn't go back to the soil, which I call the soil knowledge web. Physics, soil, chemistry, soil, biology, soil, ecosystems, soil. I mean, the list goes on. Mathematics, soil, blah, blah, blah. You could go on forever and talk about every single subject you can go find in a college in the soil or directly derived from the soil. So mainly what I do is I build soil and the plants grow themselves. Because a tomato knows how to grow a tomato and a carrot knows how to grow a carrot. But if you don't give it the conditions where it knows how to grow a carrot and knows how to grow a tomato, you're going to get mixed results. So what we're trying to do is, once again, create ecosystems and niches that provide the needs for the things that we're trying to grow. So in permaculture, we're always keeping in mind, what do we want? What do we want? What would we like to achieve? And then that drives you towards, okay, these are the factors that promote that process. These are the animals and the ecosystems that promote that process. And these are the amount of time and the resources that I have. Well, it's kind of like a little equation, and we get together and you start talking about it and you start thinking about it, and eventually you put together the system that works really well for you as an individual towards your knowledge level, your skill level, your health, your time, your resources. Because a lot of people don't have the same resources. They don't have the same time. They don't have the same energy levels. You might go out for 5 hours a day, and you might go out for four. You might go out for 10. I go out for 12 or 15 or 18 sometimes. It just depends on the day and how much I want and what I want to achieve that day. So we're using design to just make things as simple as possible, at the same time increasing the positive effects. Because we're always trying to just stack the positive effects so that we look back and say, thank you, past self, for doing all those things that made my present self life much easier. We don't want to look back and go, damn it, past self, what did you do? It's like, why did you do that? And there's been many times where I've been in that situation. It's like, why did you plant a tree there? What were you thinking? Well, it was an open spot, because that's usually what happens when you give someone a tree. They give them a tree and they kind of do this around their yard and they go, open spot. Now, was that really the best spot for that tree? Was it barely the best spot for that shrub? I would say 80% of the time, no. So taking into consideration the needs of that seeds, tree, and so on and so on. And what we do that, when we do that, we call it a, drawing a little blank here. Basically, we're trying to gather all the effects and the needs of that one plant or animal. So for example, a chicken. Chicken needs water, chicken needs food, chicken needs shelter, chicken needs company. But what does a chicken give? It gives scratching, it gives manure, it gives meat, it gives feathers, it gives pest control. So at the same time, we're trying to think of all the little interactions and actions that that one organism does. And then you go to the next one, and then you can start going, okay, how does this one connect with this one? And then it goes further and you can start connecting. And then permaculture gets to the point where you start putting things together and it starts becoming more right than you thought possible. Become like, never did I think you could have a farm that had gophers and you didn't lose anything. I mean, I always thought you'd at least lose something, but once again, that was the limit of my creativity back then. So you can't necessarily do that, even if it sounds as crazy as possible. It's possible in some way, shape, or form, based on an interaction with another organism, another person, a group of people or a group of organisms. There's always some way to find that goal that you're trying to achieve. From there, we start doing a succession. So we're always trying to go in a positive succession instead of a negative succession. So a positive succession would be forest fire. Forest fire brings small grasses, small weeds, wildflowers. Wildflowers promote enough biomass to drop on the ground to create grasses. Grasses go die, perennial grasses start showing up. The more perennial grasses you start getting, the more lignins and stuff you start getting, which promotes the soil to a little more fungal, which means now it supports herbaceous weeds like star thistle, giant Canadian horseweed, etc., which have even more lignins. Well, that slowly decomposes and drops, which promotes the soil towards more fungal, which shrubs coming in, and then eventually you end up towards climax forest. And a lot of permaculture we're trying to do is work away from annual production into perennial production, because there's no need to plant something every year. There's no need to prepare beds every year. There's no need to do all those things when you can get the same nutrition from something that would come from a tree, a shrub, or something like that. An example of this would be we have fields and fields and fields and fields and fields and fields of corn. Corn needs to be tilled every year, it needs to be sprayed every year, it needs to be basically demolished every year to go back to that succession. So every year they go up one succession and then dip back to zero, and then up succession and back to zero, and up succession and back to zero, and they always just go back to zero. An example towards a perennial system would be chestnut orchards. Chestnut has the same nutritional content and chemicals that you would get in corn. So if you wanted to, you can make high fructose chestnut syrup. If you wanted to, you can make chestnut tortillas. If you wanted to, you can make all those things. But at the same time, chestnuts drop leaf matter that builds soil. Chestnuts promote shade that builds soil. Chestnuts promote bird habitat, which they're pooping, which promotes increased fertility cycle. Chestnuts can have animals pasture under them. So now not only are you getting a tree crop, you can get an animal crop as well. You can also grow grains under it. So in some ways, you can still get your annual production under your perennial production, which is what a lot of countries are just starting to move towards nowadays. Anyways, so this is moving more and more towards a permanent agriculture and a permanent culture, which is what permaculture stands for. So the more and more practices that we do like this, the more permanent things get, and the less initial input and resources you have to put into it. So you might have to do some work on your chestnut orchard, but it's every 20 years. So every year, 20 years in Italy, they coppice their chestnuts. That allows a little more light down. That means they can grow some vegetables and stuff in there. And then the trees start growing again and eventually start shading out. But by then, next year, they're coppicing this block. And then they're kind of just doing this rotation. Well, they get their nuts. They get hardwood for building their house, their furniture, whatever they want. They get animal forage, they get biomass, they get all these things from that system versus corn, you get corn. And not only do you get corn plus the destruction of the soil, the destruction of the destruction of the ecosystem. So in some ways, we're just trying to use permaculture to move towards, once again, a more permanent agriculture and a permanent system. And this isn't very hard, it's just based on knowledge and skill, and a lot of that knowledge and skill is a bit lost in the last 100, 200 years, because those systems used to just be regular practice. For example, how did the people who came here plant all these apple orchards with basically no modern tools or equipment, no modern varieties, none of that? And there's apple trees all over here. No irrigation lines, no polytubing, no drip tape. There was knowledge and skill there that's gone that we don't necessarily have anymore. And that's one of the things with permaculture as well, is we're just trying to keep that going and pass it on and create new knowledge. And it's like, how did Craig Dambacher's great-grandpa or his great-uncle or something, he used to grow fields of potatoes where the potatoes were as big as your foot. No longer do we have this knowledge of how to grow potatoes as big as your foot with no tractor, no composting, no drip tape, no overhead irrigation sprinklers. We have absolutely no idea how he's done it. But we know that he did it because there's proof, there's pictures, et cetera, et cetera. So we're trying to also just prevent that knowledge loss as well as trying to create new knowledge. So new techniques, new innovations towards just pushing us towards the things that we want. And this doesn't necessarily need to always be about food. You could grow flowers, biomass, fuel, fiber. It's any of the things that you would need to do whatever you want. And at the same time, even an ornamental garden. There's no reason you can't have a permaculture ornamental garden, because once again, creativity is the biggest limit to abundance. If you can't have an ornamental permaculture garden in your head, you'll never get to one. But if you can even just think that it's there, it's possible. It's that little blip in the sky. You take one step towards it, the little blip gets bigger. You take one step towards it, it gets a little bigger. You learn something else, it gets a little bigger. And before you know it, it's like squishing you. And you're actually there. And then you're living in an abundant state, which is pretty amazing to have basically everything you need. I eat 98% of my diet from the farm. We grow our own grains, we grow our own meat, we grow our own animals, we grow our own grains, we grow our own veggies, herbs, fruits. The only time that 2% is basically when someone says, hey, you want to go have some lunch? And sure, I'm not going to be that guy who goes, oh no, I only eat from my farm. I can't possibly go eat lunch with you. So then we go out and have lunch and have conversations about permaculture, and then we call that being tainted. So little by little you get tainted, and you have that unlimited strawberries or the this and then that, and then you start slowly tainting other people with your stuff, and they're like, that's the best tomato I've ever had in my life. Why was it so good? Planted this ditch that had wood chips and never watered it. What do you mean? It's like, well, and then now they're interested in technique towards growing something like that, versus before it was like, just a good tomato. So we're always just using permaculture to just stimulate more positivity, more beneficial effects in basically any way possible. And it's going along really well. There's a lot of people getting into the movement. It's growing quite fast around here. There's people getting into it, planting food forests, planting gardens, switching to no-till, so no more rototilling, and care of the soil so that all these beneficial effects can start happening. And then I think we can start answering some questions, and if anyone has any. I have not figured out how to do it without the deer yet. I do have a fence, although I do believe it's possible. Because at this point, when the deer does get into the farm, for example, last year, I come into the garden and I see some tracks, and I go, oh, crap. I follow the tracks, and they walked right over the lettuce patch, and they walked right past the tomatoes, and they walked right past the zucchini and the peppers, and they walked right past the onions, and what did they go eat? They ate my mulberry tree. But because the ecosystem of the farm was so diverse, the tomato wasn't the first thing on the list. It was the deep-rooted perennial, which was gathering nutrients from really deep, because a mulberry leaf was way more nutritious than a tomato leaf, because the tree is gathering nutrients from a much deeper level. It has a mycorrhizal relationship that's been established for years. So a lot of those things happen over time based on just getting a more ecosystem. But I do believe that you can farm without a deer fence. I just have not gotten there yet. I know I can do it with an orchard, because that's pretty easy. You just grow your trees in your nursery up to a certain height and don't plant anything else that's not at least this tall. They'll browse up to the browse height, and then your tree will be fine after that. Now, vegetable garden, figuring it out. Okay, so there is the Big Black Book, which is the original permaculture book by Bill Mollison. Bill Mollison is the creator of permaculture. It's a really in-depth, detailed book. And then there's quite a few books that go into a little more of the, let's say, home-scale design. And there's also a few books that go into the farm-scale design. So it really actually just depends on what scale of permaculture you're looking at. Just getting started, I would start with the Big Black Book and just some YouTube videos and stuff. One thing I would say to someone just getting started is don't get stuck on the technique. A lot of times people come into permaculture and they see a swale and they see what swales do, and all I can think about is swales. Swales, swales, swales. We've got to put more of them here, more of them there, when that would be an improper design plan, because what you're trying to do is fit the technique to the spot and to the, what your goal is. You could set swales up that cause flooding problems. They could cause drowning problems. There could be all kinds of problems that you could cause by just creating too many of those things by getting stuck on a technique. Versus, so for an example, would say, you're going to build a house. Well, I really only like hammers. I'm just going to use the hammer to build a house. Well, what about the saw and the paintbrush and all? No, no, I'm just going to use the hammer. And it's like, sure, you might be able to build a house with just a hammer. It's not going to be a very nice house. So getting into permaculture, don't get stuck on the techniques. It's more of the design mindset of just the whole, and that everything is all connected, and there's many, many different techniques, and it's a toolbox. So you're going to go into permaculture with this new toolbox, and this tool is good for this, and this tool is good for this, and this tool is good for this. A lot of times people get stuck on that one tool, and then just always obsessed with it, and then they go put thousands of dollars worth of swales in their landscape, only to realize 3 years later that it turns out we don't really need that many swales, or it turns out we don't need any at all. So that's really one of the main things I like to point out to people who are just getting into it, is be very open mindsetted and broad, and learn many different techniques, because there's a lot of things that you might learn and go, I don't need that, only to 2 years down the line, wow, that like absolutely fits my context absolutely perfectly right now. So
you've been listening to Over the Garden Gate, a program presented by the UCCE Master Gardeners of Tuolumne County. I'm Linda Reevely. Thank you for being with us.